Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Gregory Melville and Susan Fox and Kathleen Bromage.
This is Where We Live from Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Catherine Shen. Nearly one in four American adults who contracted COVID-19 have developed long COVID symptoms. That's according to the latest census report. Coming up, Yale immunobiology expert Dr. Akiko Iwasaki will help us better understand what we know about long COVID and what we don't know. But first, March marked 4 years since the World Health Organization, also known as WHO, declared COVID-19 a pandemic. Dr. Daniel Hosang has written about the twin pandemics of COVID-19 and racism. He co-edited a book about this intersection with law professor and civil rights advocate Dr. Kimberly Crenshaw. It's called Under the Black Light, the intersectional vulnerabilities that the twin pandemics lay bare. And joining us now to help us reflect on this four-year mark is Dr. Daniel Hosang himself, who's also a professor of American Studies at Yale University. Dan, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Catherine. It's really good to be back here and really grateful for this opportunity to reflect on this moment 4 years after COVID first entered so many of our lives.
Absolutely. And we're also very grateful that you're here to help us do that reflection together. And for our listeners, you can also join the conversation. Let us know if you have any questions. 888-720-9677. That's 888-720-9677. Or leave us a comment on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. So, Dan, your book sort of came out from a speaker series back in 2020. Can you tell us what the speaker series was about and also why the metaphor of a black light?
Yeah, thanks. And I should, the book is forthcoming next year, and I'll say a little bit more about why we felt we actually needed more time to really reflect on the impact both of this crisis and what it revealed about the different forms of inequality that we face. But the black light metaphor was kind of conceptualized by Kim Crenshaw. She's a law professor at Columbia and UCLA. And the idea was, I mean, remember back in March 2020, there was so much kind of confusion and disorientation about what was happening, about what one could do to make oneself safe, about the family members and loved ones that were vulnerable. And the idea was to kind of, the black light allows us to see different forms of power, experience, inequality that our normal gaze might not allow us to do. So over a series of about 10 weeks from March until early June, and then continuing on, Professor Crenshaw had different guests. This was sponsored by her organization, the African American Policy Forum, ranging from people who worked in nursing homes to essential healthcare and food service workers, folks who worked with disabled communities, Native nations. What were you seeing? What was playing out on the ground? How are people responding to the crisis? And together it allowed us kind of once a week to come up with a picture nationally of all of the both tremendous sense of loss and vulnerability, but also possibility. So that's the black light metaphor.
And since turning that black light on, what would you say has changed since then? You know, 4 years, it's not a long time, but it's a pretty long time. And it's funny because I think I can remember those very early moments clearly, but everything after that is quite fuzzy, actually.
Yeah, I feel the same way, Catherine. It's like on the one hand, they're so vivid, right? Like these very specific moments. And on the other hand, and I was thinking about this, you know, certainly in education, K-12, but also many institutions in the last year, there's been this longing about when are we going to get back to normal? When are we going to reset? When might we be able to imagine? And, you know, in some ways that this never happened, even as we know in our own state in Connecticut, we lost more than 10,000 people, 10,000 loved ones, a million people nationally, you know, more than that, many more around the globe. And at that time, and this was a constant theme through this Under the Black Light project, was this insistence we can never go back to normal because we understood that there were so many conditions that produced both the inequality in terms of how people face and experience COVID, but also just the mass scale of loss and suffering. And there was this, you know, palpable consensus, we can't go back to that normal. We have to go to a different kind of place. And so I'm really struck, and I think that's, and it's part of what our book is taking up now, is what happened in those intervening 4 years such that we lost that will. That will to try to reimagine some of the basic connections we have with one another, the way our institutions work, et cetera. And so now that the kind of prevailing idea is we must return to normal as soon as possible.
Well, I mean, if I had a penny every time we heard the word normal or new normal, I wouldn't be sitting here right now.
Exactly.
Well, and you mentioned, you know, reimagining institutions and how they work. Can you talk about also, you know, how has trust in civic institutions changed, do you think, since then?
Yeah. I mean, I want to just say something quickly about, so, you know, I was on an early episode, and one of the things I offered was about, I mean, remember back in March of 2020, just as news was turning about the spread of the virus, whether it would come to the U.S., it was called at that time the Wuhan virus, right? Even, you know, repeating a longstanding practice of associating, you know, the spread of a virus that has no passport, it has no nation, right, with a particular place, and in this case, with a racialized understanding of this. And immediately people, you know, in the U.S., what did they, before anyone told them, they stopped going to places identified as Chinese and Asian. Chinatowns mm-hmm. emptied out.
Mm-hmm, right.
And what that showed was this longstanding underlying sense, kind of racialized sense, of how disease spreads and bacteria spread. So, you know, we confronted a 21st century health crisis with 19th century ideas. And I would say that those really haven't changed. Those underlying conditions, concerns about warehousing people, the vulnerability of seniors, people in nursing homes, so many of those conditions haven't really changed. I think because we grew so weary and there was such, I mean, to, you know, your question, Catherine, such a sense that everyone was on their own. There was no larger kind of we protecting us beyond perhaps getting access to tests and vaccination. And I think over time, that really has had the effect of withering trust in many of our institutions. And then there certainly have been political actors and interests and movements that have really used this as an opportunity to attack those institutions. And as a result, something that we thought might bring us all closer together has in some ways had the opposite effect, really, really withering our sense of what's possible and what's possible through the public good.
And, you know, we talked about what we kind of remember during those earlier moments of the pandemic, and you mentioned racialization. And I remember, of course, being in journalism, there's a lot of questions about what's happening. You know, we're seeing the news globally. It just started to trickle into the United States. Can you talk about, you know, we just mentioned racialization. What are some other earlier moments of the pandemic that you remember the most, especially in terms of indicating this shift or this change in trust and what our civic institutions were doing at the time?
Yeah, I mean, just to recall some of the early guests, and we had, you know, these one of the novelists, Viet Nguyen, Naomi Klein, Eve Ensler, N.K. Jemisin, the science fiction writer, all of them were kind of describing both what they were seeing and what they could imagine seeing moving forward. But I mean, remember healthcare workers putting garbage bags over them and over their hands.
Definitely.
Because there was no equipment. Nursing home workers and other essential workers who were, you know, staying with people's loved ones when they had no connection, coming home and finding they'd contracted the virus, you know, on their own with nothing else. So, you know, that's part of the, I think, early sense was that, you know, there was, if you remember, but like very early on in Queens, there were these neighborhoods in Jackson Heights and Elmhurst that were just devastated. The virus was spreading because people were living in closed conditions. They couldn't socially isolate from one another. They were desperately needed in the workforce. So it really, really just sharpened our understanding of all of these underlying extant inequalities. And I think that's, you know, the moment we had to really think about what can we do differently so that this doesn't happen again. And of course, we had then the murder of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor, the uprisings that followed, and the kind of deep polarization that followed that. So I think we're still trying to get our heads around
right.
both what happened and what possibilities remain for us.
Right. And that was definitely a time where all of the senses were heightened, I think, especially with everything you just mentioned that was happening basically simultaneously. And I'm remembering that at those, especially those first few months, I've done so many stories of people very kindly making masks for healthcare workers, but then later on realizing that, oh, maybe we can't use cloth masks. We have to use specific like N95 masks for it to work. So in terms of public health lessons, you know, what do you think we've learned or not learned from your perspective, especially, you know, as we're learning, as the medical institutions are learning and civic institutions are learning, there's a lot of shifting and guidance as well. So, you know, understanding that we were all sort of learning as we go, but because there was so much change, you know, what do you think we've learned or not learned from that?
Yeah, I think, Catherine, there's a couple of really important points there. One is those moments, right? People immediately mobilizing to action, all of these mutual aid groups that emerge to try to care for neighbors and friends, the, you know, provisioning of supplies, all of that is really, remember in the evening, people coming outside and ringing bells and clapping for healthcare workers. I mean, some sense of the mutuality and reciprocity. It's not a surprise, of course, that public health responses as people are trying to figure out how the virus moves, what the appropriate responses are, would change. I don't think that part is not something we should begrudge anyone in any institutions. That shifts as we get more information. But I think what it exposed is because our system of public health in general is fairly weak, most of our healthcare comes through private or state subsidized providers, we just didn't have an infrastructure that where people could turn to get reliable information. There was never a sense of someone you might know from your local community showing up, checking in on you, asking if you need something. So it was, you know, so uneven across so many places. And I think the effect of that, even when the information was strong or was developing, was, again, to reinforce the sense that, look, I'm kind of on my own here. Nobody really is thinking about the greater good. And I'm not suggesting that there were not people across all levels of government that really were working around that. But the experience was that effectively I'm on my own. And when you're waiting 2 hours in line for a test, remember that period,
right,
later in the time, or figuring out about vaccination cards, it just has the effect of withering that trust. The last thing I'll say is that when some people responded and said, I'm unsure, let's say, about the vaccine, about masking protocols, et cetera, I think there was an insistence to moralize that stand and say, well, if you don't believe that, that means you are standing in the way of addressing this crisis. And that certainly was a mistake, because we shouldn't be surprised that people have lots of different experiences with medicine, with care, with expertise and advice. And we didn't really have many pathways to open up those questions. We too often shut those down.
Right. And an experience that came out from that, too, is discovering long COVID, which we'll be talking about after a quick break in a little bit. But talking about and thinking about vulnerability, I want to play a bite here from Lisa McCorkle, who's a co-founder of the Patient-Led Research Collaborative. And they've compiled a lot of data around long COVID. So let's take a listen here.
The people who are most impacted by long COVID, like the highest prevalence rates, are in women, transgender people, people who had pre-existing disabilities, Hispanic, Latino populations, and poor communities as well. So this is a health equity issue deep down. Part of it is potentially that a lot of those populations were the ones at the front lines, and so exposed to COVID more, have less resources to be able to rest in the early days of their COVID infection, which there's research that shows that impacts your likelihood of getting long COVID. But so when we already have this inequitable distribution of long COVID in the population that's focusing on already marginalized populations, that is disastrous for receiving care, receiving adequate support. The experience of a long COVID patient right now that has access to resources and access to the medical system is someone jumping around from specialist to specialist after waitlist, paying thousands and thousands of dollars. Even that patient is not really seeing meaningful improvements. And so when you don't have the necessary resources to do that, it's just exacerbating these inequities that we see.
So Dan, Lisa covered a lot in that short bite here. Anything you want to add about?
Support for this podcast comes from Hartford Healthcare.
Elevating Health is funded by Hartford HealthCare. ECMO is a leading-edge, life-saving treatment for patients with cardiac or respiratory failure. Dr. Jason Gluck, director of the Mechanical Circulatory Support Program and Emergency Cardiac Care at Hartford Hospital, explains what it is.
So ECMO stands for extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, outside the body oxygenation of blood. It's a life support technique that's used by highly sophisticated medical systems for patients with severe heart or lung failure. The technique involves removing blood from the body, oxygenating it, and then returning it back.
ECMO procedures happen in the ICU, but not all hospitals are equipped with the necessary technology and staff. Dr. Gluck describes Hartford Hospital's ECMO Go team.
So ECMO is considered when treatments have failed, and in our center, with a special ECMO on the go team, we'll actually take that technology to their hospital and help them out there if they need to stabilize the patient and then bring them back to heart for recovery.
For more information, go to ctpublic.org/elevatinghealth.
The links between COVID and long COVID, or even just the inequity experience in general as well?
Yeah, I mean, what's so striking, Catherine, about Lisa's comments are how exactly they map on to so much of what all of the contributors to this project in 2020 were saying about the underlying inequalities that COVID lay bare. So it's clear that those are absolutely continuing to determine people's life experiences. I mean, a couple of other things is the kind of movement of COVID from something that was socially experienced, a social crisis in which everyone had an interest and obligation in confronting and figuring out together, to something that people navigate on their own in a largely individuated system where you have to be your own advocate. And I think that, you know, in many ways, this has come full circle. Those were the weak links of our health system and our public health system that now people with long COVID are experiencing most acutely. The last thing I'll say, Catherine, the last time we talked, you know, in the fall, it was about these histories of eugenics and kind of questions of fitness, especially in our state of Connecticut. And, you know, several people have pointed to that underlying sense that the takeaway from this was, well, people who have the resources, the health, the means, the fit, the strong, they're kind of destined to survive this. And if you don't have that, well, you're kind of in tough luck. And I'm just struck at how so much of that logic works back to, right, you know, a much uglier history of eugenics in which people were ranked by their fitness. So I think it's a reminder that we carry so many of these ideas with us today, and that transforming them, the possibilities, challenges, opportunities are still very much in front of us.
And we certainly will be discussing more about the self-advocacy as well in the next segment. Thank you very much. You've been listening to Dr. Daniel Hosang, who's a professor of American Studies at Yale University, also the co-author of the forthcoming book, Under the Black Light, The Intersectional Vulnerabilities That the Twin Pandemics Lay Bare. Thank you so much, Dan, for being with us today.
Thank you, Catherine.
And coming up, we talk about what we know and don't know about long COVID. If you have questions or want to share your experience with long COVID with us, you can join the conversation 888-720-9677 or find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. And just a quick reminder that we're in the middle of our April pledge break, so consider making a donation, help us keep us going. And here are two of my colleagues to tell you more. This is Where We Live from Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Catherine Shen. We now know a lot about COVID-19, how it shows up, how it spreads, and how to treat it. But we're still learning about its long-term effects. Roughly 1 in 4 people who contract COVID-19 have long COVID. And here to help us unpack the state of science around long COVID is Dr. Akiko Iwasaki. She's the co-lead investigator at the Yale COVID-19 Recovery Study and also the Sterling Professor of Immunobiology at the Yale University School of Medicine. Thank you so much, Dr. Iwasaki, for being with us this morning.
Thank you, Catherine, for having me.
And for our listeners, if you have any questions or you want to share your experience with long COVID, let us know, 888-720-9677, or leave us a comment on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. So Dr. Iwasaki, you were following the conversation between Dan and I and on the reflections about COVID and long COVID, and even to the clip that we heard from the patient-led research collaborative around equity. Can you talk about if you have any thoughts on either of those points, you know, anything that jumped out to you?
Yeah, so I'm a basic scientist, immunologist studying the biological basis of long COVID. And the discussion around the health inequity and, you know, especially women being at more higher risk for developing long COVID, those things are really coming through in our own research. And we're also trying to understand, in addition to social factors, what biological factors might lead to this increased risk in women.
And how would you define long COVID?
So long COVID is an umbrella term that describes a collection of diseases, conditions where individuals continue to experience persistent symptoms or develop new symptoms for at least 4 weeks after the acute phase of COVID-19. And these symptoms, there are over 200 symptoms that are reported, but the major ones include fatigue, shortness of breath, pain, cognitive difficulties, sleep disturbances, exercise intolerance, and many more. Like I said, this is not a single disease, but likely consisting of several different groups of diseases.
Right. And so would you say the definition depends on the symptoms that you have, or whether you're 4 weeks after COVID or 12 weeks? You know, do we have an idea how that works?
Yeah, so the four-week time point was a clinical definition that was proposed by the CDC. But that's the other issue, is that long COVID doesn't really have a uniform definition of how we define these things. So some places define it as 4 weeks, others 12 weeks, and so on. But what we know by looking at these patients is that people suffer months to years after the infection, and there is a lot of overlapping symptoms, as I mentioned, but there are also unique ones that are different between males and females, for example.
And so earlier we heard from Lisa McCorkle, who's the co-founder of the Patient-Led Research Collaborative, about some of their grassroots research. And she got COVID in March of 2020. And after experiencing symptoms for more than a month after an infection, she joined the Body Politic COVID-19 Support Group. So we're going to hear another quick clip from Lisa McCorkle here.
I joined that very eagerly and was really taken aback by how many other people were experiencing the same thing that I was. We all had, you know, maybe slightly different symptoms, slightly different experiences, but we're not recovering after our infection. And a group of us who had some research background, some data backgrounds, saw this need for collecting everyone's experiences that they were sharing in the support group and trying to identify trends and symptoms and, you know, if people were trying different treatments, what that was like, even just trying to collate the experiences of people being dismissed by their providers, because pretty much all of us at that point were being told it was in our heads, it's not something to worry about, and not receiving adequate care by our healthcare system. And especially at that time, you know, most of us couldn't receive, didn't have access to COVID-19 tests. And so didn't have that, you know, confirmed case, which led to a lot of the dismissal as well, both at the beginning and later on. So that group of us put together a survey, and that survey resulted in what is now known as the first research on long COVID. We just posted it as a Google Doc. It wasn't, you know, published anywhere officially, but it documented over 60 symptoms that people were experiencing. It documented the stigma people were experiencing, and it got the attention of the CDC and some media outlets, and really demonstrated, you know, there's this potential for having long-term symptoms and conditions that pop up after a COVID infection. And we really should have known that this was a thing before, you know, we shouldn't have had to do this research in order for it to become well known. That just goes to show how neglected those illnesses were prior to the COVID pandemic, that we, you know, did not prepare for that or weren't talking about it at the beginning.
So this survey that Lisa has mentioned has since been peer-reviewed and republished with more than 200 total symptoms listed. And Dr. Iwasaki, earlier you mentioned that there are 200 symptoms as well. And Lisa also said that this is one of the most cited papers in long COVID research. So Dr. Iwasaki, have you heard of the patient-led research collaborative, or have you leaned on the surveys that she mentioned here in terms of, you know, helping you with your own research as well?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, a lot of the numbers that I quote are based on the work that Lisa McCorkle and Hannah Davis and many others at Patient-Led have done. They've really led the way in terms of research and surveying patient symptoms and their experiences, and have really done an enormous contribution to this field. Without their work, we wouldn't be able to study what we're doing right now. So I just want to really appreciate what they do. And absolutely, they are really informing the world about the status of long COVID on a daily basis.
And, you know, we talk about 200 symptoms. That's a lot of symptoms. Can you talk about what's the range of those of that list?
Yes. So you can divide these symptoms up into many different sort of features. But the core symptoms, as I mentioned before, really include systemic things like severe fatigue and exertional intolerance and cognitive impairment. And, you know, just pain and flu-like symptoms in others. For instance, when we look at the six differences in symptoms reported, hair loss was the most sexually dimorphic symptom, meaning that the females were reporting hair loss, more than males. And in males, the most the top male dominant feature was sexual dysfunction. So just looking at these kinds of symptoms and separating them into biological sexes, we're already starting to see the involvement of different drivers that could be distinct in males and females.
And so I want to share a thought that National Institute of Health Director Monica Bertagnoli recently stated, that active COVID virus can be found in bodies months post-infection. And some research hypothesizes viral persistence is a driver for long COVID, as well as other post-viral illnesses like myalgic encephalomyelitis or chronic fatigue syndrome. So this sounds very similar to what Lisa just shared as well. So doctor, can you talk about the significance of what Monica mentioned from your perspective, especially when you're researching how this all operates?
Yes. So there are roughly four possible kind of hypotheses that can describe long COVID. And because long COVID is a heterogeneous disease, these kinds of drivers are likely happening in people, but maybe not all within the same person. Viral reservoir or replicating viruses that persist, that's one of the four hypotheses. And, as the director mentions, there is numerous evidence for this. Dr. Amy Prowell has published a very nice review demonstrating how many of these tissues are involved in harboring these kinds of replicating viruses, or at least remnants of viral RNA and viral proteins. The three other hypotheses include autoimmunity. So often what happens during an acute infection with the virus is that bystander cells that are not responsive to the virus but are reactive to the host antigens, they get stimulated. And once you develop autoimmunity, it's very difficult to get rid of it because the antigen is everywhere. The third hypothesis is tissue damage and dysfunction that occur as a result of infection. And we see evidence of, reactive microglia in the brain that sort of damages the surrounding cell types, including the neurons. And that could lead to neurocognitive impact that are reported by so many. And finally, we see evidence in some people of latent herpes virus reactivation. These include things like Epstein-Barr virus that 95% of adults carry, but they're in a dormant form. However, in people with long COVID, we see more active form of this virus in a subset. So these four possible root causes could be driving long COVID.
And so with what you just stated as well, and with the long list of symptoms, can you talk about, you know, what's the process of getting diagnosed for long COVID? You know, especially we've been talking about how there's so many ways that it can show up. It could be anything.
So the process of diagnosis right now is a little bit complicated because the diagnostic, there is no tool or diagnostic biomarkers that doctors can order to say if whether somebody has long COVID or not. We're working very hard to try to come up with such biomarkers so that it's easier for people to get diagnosed. However, currently what's happening is that people, you know, present these symptoms to their physicians. And hopefully if the physicians are aware of the collection of symptoms that are commonly reported by people with long COVID, they will be able to diagnose them as having long COVID, you know, after the sort of infection phase, you know, after ruling out some other causes that could be leading to the symptoms.
And because you're also doing ongoing research as well, and Lisa McCorkle earlier mentioned, you know, interest, the state of interest in and having money to fund research around long COVID. Can you give us an idea of, you know, what's that look like? Is there interest and is there funding to do research around long COVID?
So there is not enough funding to do a proper or large scale studies on long COVID. There's the NIH Recover Initiative that funded some groups during the earlier phase. But, you know, we still need sufficient funding to do large studies such as randomized clinical trials to better understand what drugs can be can be helpful for people with long COVID. And there are some that are going on, including our own, but we need a lot more of these, and not just randomized clinical trial to see if something works, but to see what works in what people. If we can find biomarker of benefit for a particular drug, we could then try to seek for people with those biomarkers and administer drugs of benefit to those people. So again, going back to this disease process, if we can understand it better, we can get a better biomarker and better therapeutic strategy for that particular driver.
You've been listening to Dr. Akiko Iwasaki, who's the co-lead investigator for the Yale COVID-19 Recovery Study and also the Sterling Professor of Immunobiology at the Yale University School of Medicine. Let us know if you have any questions or if you want to share your experience with us with long COVID. Join the conversation, 888-720-9677, or find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live from Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Catherine Shen. Back with us to help us better understand what we know or don't know about long COVID is Dr. Akiko Iwasaki. She's the co-lead investigator with the Yale COVID-19 Recovery Study and also a professor of immunobiology at the Yale University School of Medicine. So earlier we heard from Lisa McCorkle, who's the co-founder of the Patient-Led Research Collaborative, and she spoke about the level of medical education and for patients self-advocacy that's required, which is also something that we talked about a little bit with our conversation with Dr. Daniel Hosang. So Dr. Iwasaki, would love to get your thoughts, you know, particularly about what Lisa has called the neglected illnesses that are a part of long COVID.
Lisa's absolutely right about this. There's very little knowledge base that is taught currently in medical schools to doctors who to inform them about these what we call post-acute infection syndromes, which is known to occur after encounter with many distinct pathogens. SARS-CoV-2 or COVID-19 is the latest one to join this list, but there have been reports for Ebola, dengue, polio, SARS, chikungunya, EBV, influenza, and many other viruses, as well as bacterial and parasitic pathogens that lead to very similar outcomes, months or years after the infection. So this type of medical education to educate the physicians so that they can recognize and treat these diseases appropriately is a much needed effort.
And Lisa also touched on the need for non-behavioral treatments as well and what exactly that means. So we're going to hear another quick clip here from Lisa.
So on clinicaltrials.gov, which is a list of, all the clinical trials that are registered right now, only 30% are on non-behavioral interventions for long COVID. So that's another reason why we're trying to push for non-behavioral, is that it's not like there's just so much effort being put into behavioral and trying to change, you know, our behavior, when we know that we're likely going to need a drug in order to be cured. There's only so much, even if some behavioral intervention has some improvement, it's not going to be to the level that is going to result in a meaningful change to quality of life, a meaningful change to patient outcomes generally.
So Dr. Iwasaki, you know, your response to what Lisa has to say here in terms of behavioral versus non-behavioral treatments?
Yeah, again, I absolutely agree with Lisa. You know, behavioral therapies may be beneficial to a subset of people, but the kind of underlying biological insights that we're getting, there are actually drugs that interfere directly with these processes. And behavioral, I'm not sure exactly how they're going to interfere with these biological processes. But for instance, the viral reservoir hypothesis we already discussed, you know, that can be treated with antivirals like Paxlovid. And at Yale, with Dr. Harlan Krumholtz's group, we have enrolled people in randomized clinical trials to test the effect of Paxlovid to see if we can get rid of the reservoir and improve the lives of these people. And for the other three hypotheses, there are also drugs that can target. For instance, this inflammatory conditions that could be happening can be targeted by anti-inflammatory drugs. And there will be a large trial that's happening from Dr. Wes Eli's group at Vanderbilt University, where an anti-inflammatory drug called baricitinib is going to be tested in people with long COVID. And we're also a part of that trial as well. So there are a lot of important biological drugs that can be used to target these root cause disease drivers. And it would be a waste not to investigate these in a rigorous scientific manner.
And we've covered a lot from this conversation in terms of what we know about COVID-19 and whatnots. But I want to ask, you know, what do we know that we don't know about long COVID? You know, what's top of mind for you in terms of your research, Dr. Iwasaki?
So we are getting a lot of clues about these different hypotheses we discussed already. But what we don't know, for example, is the sequence of event that happens within an individual that lead to this disease. Something we didn't talk about is that we're also finding a lot of neuroendocrine dysfunction in people with long COVID, leading to lower levels of cortisol and lower levels of sex hormones in people, and that really correlate with the outcome, their immunological outcomes as well. So, you know, how do we restore the sort of central nervous system defect that's then leading to the dysregulation of these organs that are target of these hormones? That's a major kind of a challenge for the entire field, because there isn't any clear-cut or existing drugs that can, you know, reset these types of inflammatory procedures that's happening in the brain. But there are experimental drugs that are being tried in the animal models that are showing some promise. So there may be something we can do in the future to really target these the core problems that's happening within the central nervous system.
Well, and Lisa McCorkle from the Patient-Led Research Collaborative earlier also spoke on some of the stigmas that patients do experience when they're in the doctor's office or whatnot. So, you know, can you talk about some of the stigmas that does happen when patients are looking for treatment, only to be told maybe that it's not what they think it is?
Yes. Yeah, so I'm not a medical doctor and I don't see patients, but I do hear a lot from patients. I'm in close communication with so many. And this is a really terrible problem of the medical establishment, in that they're being dismissed and gaslit and not just being believed for what they have. And really, we need to change this from the fundamental, treatment of patients standpoint, as well as better educating the physicians to understand these diseases, and because it's a collection of symptoms that people present with. and to be able to properly diagnose and treat people. Now, fortunately, there are many amazing physicians like Lisa Sanders at Yale, who is doing exactly that, a holistic approach to treating people with long COVID. But we need to basically clone Lisa and, just sort of distribute doctors that are really competent and knowledgeable and compassionate around the world.
And just want to get some final thoughts from you as well, Dr. Iwasaki. You know, it's been such a long process. You know, as we mentioned earlier, 4 years is not a long time, but it's been quite a long time for many people. You know, what do you hope our listeners take away from this? You know, do you think they'll get some answers soon, especially for those who might be suffering from long COVID?
Yes, I don't want to promise anything.
Sure, of course.
Soon. But, I just want patients to know that so many of us are working so hard to try to understand the disease process and to try to come up with better diagnosis and treatment. And I also want to, mention Dr. David Petrino, whom we've been, studying these diseases together for the last 4 years. People like him kind of give me hope that, people at the forefront of, interacting with patients, they're getting the insights on a daily basis. We at the laboratory bench, basic scientists like ourselves, we're also getting a lot of insights on a daily basis. So combined with the patient, reports and patient-led groups and others, I think we can hopefully come to a better understanding of how we can diagnose and treat long COVID and ME/CFS and, post-Lyme disease syndromes and many other post-acute infection syndromes.
Well, thank you very much for that, Dr. Iwasaki. Certainly, we will have to we'll have to touch base with you in a little bit for more updates at some point. You've been listening to Dr. Akiko Iwasaki, who's the co-lead investigator for the Yale COVID-19 Recovery Study, and she's also the Sterling Professor of Immunobiology at the Yale University School of Medicine. Thank you so much, Dr. Iwasaki, for helping us understand long COVID a little bit more today.
Thank you so much, Catherine.
I'm Catherine Shen. Today's show is produced by Katie Pellico. Our technical producer is Dylan Reyes. Download Where We Live anytime on your favorite podcast app. And just a quick reminder that we are in the middle of our April pledge drive. So consider going on to ctpublic.org/donate to make a quick donation. And here's also two of my colleagues to tell you more.